I'd like to take the opportunity by way of this video to inform you about the nature of my work in cultural anthropology, the trajectory of my ethnographic fieldwork, and how my personal and professional lives are mutually implicating. As I noted in the afterword to a book chapter I recently wrote, within anthropology over the past 20 years, interest has grown for considering the close relationship between history, motivation, and the particulars of ethnographic fieldwork. Specifically, how do these factors have bearing on the construction of theory and the conduct of scholarly life? Personal and professional experiences, together with historical context, lead individual researchers to their own particular methodological and theoretical approaches. Anthropological fieldwork is shaped by personal and professional identities, just as these identities are inevitably shaped by individual experiences while in the field. Unfortunately, the autobiographical dimension of ethnographic research has been downplayed historically, if not discounted altogether. In this video, I will show you something about the kind of research and teaching that I do through talking about the core questions that motivate me as a scholar and which emerge from my pursuit of personal meaning. At the center of a constellation of practical questions about the human condition lie a few that are essential parts to my anthropology. As points of inquiry, these essential questions drive my interest both in being a generalist anthropologist and in fostering a more engaged public anthropology. There are four basic questions. How are increasingly global forces translated into the everyday lives and experiences of people who work to provide for themselves and their families? For example, how does a second-generation auto worker in Ypsilanti, Michigan, come to terms with the fact that he will not have the security that his father enjoyed, which enabled the family into which this young worker was born to live by the standards of a middle-class income, even while his father did work socially deemed blue-collar? Within the context of sometimes bewildering change, by what means do people attempt to live personally and culturally meaningful and fulfilling lives? When this unionized worker is furloughed for months at a time, what does he do to fill that time in anticipation of what seems inevitable, being let go even before he has a chance to build the nest egg that might have seemed promised to him? How do people differ in their ability to achieve this fulfillment? How is this worker's prospects different from those of a worker with whom he works side by side on the line? A question which should then necessarily lead us to the next. In what ways might we trace this difference in ability to cultural, historical, and economic factors, which affect various social groups differently? For example, how is his family's race and the ability of his father to buy a home in the suburbs where property values have climbed, rather than in the city of Detroit where they have long declined, changed the opportunities that are available to this worker now? I've done a good deal of research as a practicing cultural anthropologist. I have designed and conducted four different projects over the past 8 years, and I'm beginning another now. These range from investigating migration and community building in Indonesia, to tracking non-economic urban to rural migration in the U.S., to exploring forms of new work in the post-industrial economy, and to documenting varied expressions of the therapeutic use of place in intentionally created communities, such as 19th century mental asylums and new urbanist developments. And I've successfully published on all of this work. But I'm here to tell you something that you would not likely get from reading my CV. When considering who I am and what I'm about as a scholar, I want to make clear that the actual research is of secondary importance. It's really only what I did. It's the outward expression of something more fundamentally important to knowing where I've been and where I'm going as a scholar. The questions that motivate me to do the kind of research that I do are primary. They have guided me to certain fieldwork projects. and it is these things which will continue to drive me to complete the work that I aspire to do. After all, in the presentation I make here in this video, we're talking about some level, on some level, about my vocation. In a sense, all too often forgotten, then, this is something which speaks to my calling to certain kinds of work. And in the end, I want you to know, by way of my presentation here in this video, not just about what I've done as an anthropologist, but also why I have done it. And so, let me begin on a personal note. Coming back from the Korean War and starting a career with a paternalistic corporation during post-World War II and the economic boon of that era, and on his way to start a family in the suburbs, my father's case is emblematic of an enduring vision of the American dream. In this vision, a worker's loyalty to the company is rewarded with upward mobility. Although he was at IBM for years, he was let go during one of their earliest downsizings in the early 1990s, and I watched how this affected him. I saw that it affected him deeply. The job that had defined him in ways that I could not have imagined was over. It defined him in ways that I'm sure he was previously unaware. And in the end, he was left to ask himself, what had I done wrong, and what am I to do now? Just as I tell my students when I start a project, I start at a place that matters to me. It is not only interesting, but also somehow meaningful to me. I think about how starting here could lead me to a point where I am to make a difference in the world. This might be right here at home, as it was in my case, or it might not. From the very personal experience of watching my father flounder after being downsized from his self-defining job, something which has become all too real in the current economic downturn that we're experiencing in 2009, I became interested in the role played by what people do for a livelihood in the construction of personal identity. My research projects, especially those conducted in the United States in the past several years, have been driven by this interest and the questions that flow from it. My dissertation research entailed fieldwork in the rapidly growing but still largely rural communities of northwestern Lower Michigan. I explored so-called non-economic or urban-to-rural migration of middle-class families. I looked at those who were tragically downsized from their jobs, as well as those that voluntarily downshifted from their high-stress corporate careers. And I interpret their relocation as a manner of negotiating a tension between personal experience with material demands in pursuit of a livelihood and persistent cultural conventions for the good family life. This fieldwork considers how the accounts of these migrants are part of a larger story of what constitutes the good life when basic social categories and cultural meanings are shifting. What is work? What is family? What is community? And what does it mean to be successful? A question which we ask ourselves even more broadly as a nation, and again in light of our economic downturn most recently. What is the meaning of life? I argue that their migration is a continuation of a long-standing American ideal of starting over that's rooted in the belief that a person can remake him or herself through sheer force of will. At the same time, their migration is also a uniquely modern expression as people respond to both the challenges and opportunities of a post-industrial economy. More recent work as a postdoctoral fellow at the Alfred P. Sloan Center builds on this experience by exploring what I have called new work. I use this term to describe alternative arrangements of work and family life. Seeking to find new ways of doing and thinking about things, these alternative lifestyles are fashioned by so-called free agents of the new economy. And this project reveals how some individuals and groups explore a kind of frontier, if you will, of social and economic configurations. And in so doing, they are gradually helping to redefine the meaning, purpose, and place of work in personal, family, and community life. I will tell a few stories in this presentation. For stories are the ethnographer's stock and trade. Ethnography, after all, is composed of two important and complementary sides. On the one hand, it's a process. It's the literal telling, listening, and living of stories. And on the other, it is that literary product in the form of a story. When the work is done, we have the written ethnography itself, which tells, sometimes in convincing prose, the tale of fieldwork. It's no accident that artfully written ethnographies and socially observant novels are close cousins. They each share a place of kinship, in a kinship continuum, if you will, of narrative forms. On this continuum, I would also place biography and memoir, as well as the important work of documentarians and good journalists. And so now I turn to narrative and offer a brief vignette. This is a story fragment given from the life of one of the many people with whom I've worked. I came to know Susan through my dissertation fieldwork in northern Michigan. And although the story is not my own, in telling it, I do say something about my own story. I have found that there is so often a close connection between ethnographic fieldwork and the biographical details of the researcher. The nature of our fieldwork in ethnography expresses something essential about who we are, even as it has the capacity to transform us. In the end, one constitutes the other. At the time that we met, Susan was a single woman in her mid-30s. And after completing her undergraduate degree in the Midwest, she moved to sunny California in the early 90s. In a manner akin to the gold rush of an earlier era, she followed the promise of the dot-com boom. Unlike that rush, she went believing that it was not riches that motivated her. Rather, it was her faith in the character of the work that she would be doing. She thought that she had found new meaning and purpose in socially significant work at a Silicon Valley software firm. She believed powerfully in the energetic young company's avowed mission to contribute to a greater good. She explains, "The company I worked for was in the throes of what's been going on the last 10 years in Silicon Valley," and this was speaking to what was happening in the 1990s. "It was pretty crazy," she says. "Really exciting, high energy, and working hard, making a difference. We were doing geographic information system software. All over the world it was being used for really incredible things. It was important." But there came a point, however, when the foundation for her belief shifts as the logic of late capitalism and corporate profit-seeking in the name of shareholders causes a divergence from the values that initially guided the development of the company and attracted ideologically driven young workers like her. The context within which she makes decisions sways as her workplace, like the world of work more generally, is shaken by rapidly shifting priorities and increasingly global economic imperatives. She continues, "All of a sudden, we bought a bigger company than we were, and we were trying to go public, and there was all these politics involved. All of a sudden, it's all about money and not the application. We're a bunch of young 20, 30-year-olds, even the president of the company, the person who started it. We were trying to merge with this other company, and it got really ugly." This is a point where what I have called the worker believer questions faith in a company and its promises. Susan enters a period of crisis and uncertainty. This experience culminates in a decision to embark on a quest for more personally defined meanings of identity, located or perhaps rooted outside of the realm of work. Despite howls of disapproval from nearly everyone she knows, Susan leaves her well-paying job. Downshifting, she decides to start over in a physical place, a geographic location that she remembers from childhood vacations as a kind of refuge. As a lifestyle migrant to northern Michigan, when she spoke of her act of relocation, Susan referred to how something drove me to put myself in a position where I'd be forced to figure out what matters in life. That's a risk, but God, it has to be done. As I'd heard many times before, Susan told how she felt that she had spent most of her adult life trying to become things, whether it's successful in your career or having a title or a salary or a label. It's always I am this, or I am that, or I did this, or this is who I am, sort of thing. Like others in my recent research on what I call new work, Susan was certain that she would find what matters beyond titles, degrees, and labels. She felt she could get there by moving to a place that she perceived would allow her to adopt a revised notion of what constitutes the good life. In our conversation, she spoke mostly of place. In this context, we might think of place as an intimate personal attachment to a particular landscape. She used place when describing how she chose to leave behind a fast-paced, high-paying corporate life for one less financially compensated, but deliberately rooted in the personally meaningful physical and ideological landscape of northern Michigan. She imagined this place would somehow support her decision to remake herself. And she says, "The water and the dunes, the open space, the seasons. You feel a part of outdoors up here, more so than any place I've ever lived. You feel like your life is not your home, the footprint of your house, your work. You realize that it's bigger than that. It's a lot bigger than that. Your life kind of expands. It expands even into that old boat stored back in the woods." Susan's description artfully expresses how her life became a literal part of physical place on Earth. We see graphically how she claims ownership of elements of what we might call local character as a basic part of self. She explains how it's possible to feel that your life is bigger than your home and work, how your psychic space can be purposefully enlarged. Person and place become entwined in an embodied experience where an old boat tucked away in the woods behind the house becomes an acknowledged part of individual character and enduring sense of self. So what motivates me? What are my scholarly convictions? The central theme of my work has concerned looking at how people make sense of their lives within different cultural, social, and physical contexts at different points in history. I'm interested in how forces at work within these different contexts variously enable or constrain thought and action. How do they shape our sense of who we are and what we might become as persons or as places? A basic problem for the cultural anthropologist is to understand how people constitute meaningful and fulfilling lives within a given culture. How, for example, does Susan or my father take certain lessons from prevailing and at times conflicting cultural models in a personal search for meaning? To better frame this discussion, let's consider the anthropologist Clifford Geertz and what he has said about the nature of culture. Although less fashionable in postmodernist ways of thinking, his notion remains a highly instructive way and provides a means of thinking about culture that, if nothing else, makes intuitive sense. Geertz asserts that culture consists of certain models for understanding the world and our place in it. Specifically, he sees culture as fundamentally models of and models for reality. As models of reality, cultural patterns constitute perceived worlds of human actors. They speak to how the world is. They thus represent a certain worldview. As models for reality, cultural patterns offer a way of seeing into moral worlds and allow an analysis of the sense of obligation that people feel based on shared categories of meaning. Here, cultural patterns speak to how those that hold these categories of meaning believe that the world should be. They are thus a kind of ethos. As suggested, just before sharing a bit of Susan's story, I believe that there's a close connection between ethnographic research and the life of the ethnographer as a scholar, a teacher, and even more personally. Because this connection is not merely an unavoidable fact, but also an essential, acknowledged component of ethnographic fieldwork, one of my goals is to reveal something of the nature of my scholarly convictions. Although one might not normally speak in terms of conviction when referring to academic pursuits, I believe that there's a great deal at stake. In the case of my own discipline of anthropology, I would argue that we should be engaged directly in public debates on questions ranging from multiculturalism and migration to development, education, health, and human rights. I teach my students that the value of research conducted in a variety of contexts is that it engages and encourages us to be open to possibilities and to imagine new ways of thinking. One of the basic characteristics of an anthropological approach is that it is comparative. This is a valuable frame for making the familiar unfamiliar, so as to highlight hidden patterns of meaning in what seems the mundane details of our everyday lives. At first glance, the geographic and apparent topical distance between my domestic and international research projects and their sites may appear too great to offer much in the way of comparative insight, but this is not the case. Here we see a map of the equatorial region of Southeast Asia, the Philippines and Australia, Philippines to the north, Australia to the south. And it was here that I conducted a year-long Fulbright project with government-sponsored migrants in Indonesia. They're called transmigrants in the local parlance of Indonesia, transmigrasi, orang transmigran, and so on. And here in the Republic of Indonesia, my work offered insight into how I could later interpret the experiences of downsize and downshifting workers in the United States who, like Susan, used relocation as a way of intentionally starting over. That one may not have been apparent at the time, but it was something that I came to learn later, how much insight I would be given by that earlier work in Indonesia. So let's talk about that work. Here we have a map of the Damoga Valley, which is in the North Sulawesi province in the northern section of the island of Sulawesi, or sometimes referred to as Celebes, in the Republic of Indonesia, just south of the Philippines. So here in the primary village of my fieldwork in Sulawesi, Indonesia, 350 households were relocated by the Indonesian government as part of a vast resettlement program that was aimed at providing opportunities for mostly landless poor from the very densely populated islands of Java and Bali. Families in this village, which was known as and is known as Wardi Agung, came from several different areas of Bali. Although they were all Balinese, they represented important regional differences in cultural practice. Rather than allowing people to fall back into these differences, early village leaders used the opportunity presented by physically, emotionally, and spiritually upsetting forced relocation from Bali to northern Sulawesi to pare down and standardize their cultural practices. A rather remarkable thing. They believed that differences imported from all over Bali might make it difficult to form a viable, sustainable community in this vastly different place. And so they also realized that internal tension might make them vulnerable to real or imagined threats from indigenous people in the destination area, most of whom were unhappy with their arrival and might actually have posed a threat. In a series of deliberations within the next few months, village leaders fashioned a unique religious and cultural order peculiar to that and particular to that village alone as a kind of symbolic and practical common ground. A man essential in establishing the village's basic social organization explained that, quote, although in Bali we came from many areas with different traditions, all it took was us to decide what we needed to do was to formulate a kind of unity or common set of practices that we would apply here in Wardi Agung. In this way, we deliberated so that we would not have a splitting up by cultural practices that are in Bali, but rather a tradition that is particular to Wardi Agung. The village's present spiritual leader summed up the meaningful differences for community building that he felt existed between this village, Wardi Agung, and what prevailed in their home of Bali. Here there is consciousness about what we do. People feel at one together, whereas in Bali everyone is different and on their own. It is true that cultural matters we are lacking. When compared to Bali, we could not preserve the arts. But in Bali, you have everyday customs competing with religion. This is less a problem here. We have focused on the guidance of religion, not customs. Here we keep things close to the scriptures, so that we can all agree on something basic. It is religion that has become the base for carrying out our customs. Although in Bali, all faith is placed in the Pandita, to know how to do things. Here, we discuss everything. Beyond this experiment in cultural editing, initiated by forming a distinct set of cultural and religious elements as the foundation for building lasting community, many individuals in Wordy spoke of how they followed this lead in their choice to leave behind what they had come to feel were personal bad habits. Indonesian trans migrants, individually and collectively, were using relocation as a way to selectively edit out or enhance certain personal characteristics and elements of shared or unshared culture. And as suggested before this brief example, I was able to reveal a similar process, as we saw before, among migrants in the United States, like Susan, who relocated in order to bring about what they felt were necessary breaks from established routine, from personal and cultural convention. In both cases, people used relocation to redefine priorities and in many cases to get in touch with what they described as more essential or inward identities. If nothing else, the range of my work suggests that I'm something of a generalist. And while I do describe myself as an unapologetic generalist, practical considerations dictate that I must have a specialty, and I do. I specialized in the ethnography of everyday life. Regardless of where I may choose to do my fieldwork, this is my focus. But this is a specialty that by nature is necessarily as wide-ranging as the lives of those with whom I work. And I'll explain what I mean by this through an example. Basic questions, like those with which I began this presentation, encourage me to follow people's routes, if you will, across varied domains of life, from home to work to community and back again. And in tracing their steps, patterns of meaning and practice emerge in daily rituals of personal lives and in social networks that bind people together in relationships of obligation. In my work, informants are allowed to define these rituals and networks in daily activity. Details will emerge through my careful collecting of their accounts and recording of their activities, as well as in our simple act of sharing time together, thus in observation and in participation. By following their lead, I am drawn deeper into webs of meaning, taken to places where I did not and usually could not expect to go. For example, there is this case where a participant in a recent project brought me on a visit to see his dying father in a hospice home. His father is frail and unconscious, and as we sit with our backs against the cool concrete of a nearby hall, he relates to me how it seems that as his father's life fades, he is coming out from behind a shadow. As much as he will mourn the loss of his last parent, he can see himself finally free of the judgment that he perceived held him back from taking a much-needed course change in his life. I did not expect to be in this place. Once again, I find myself on grounds of theory and practice where I am a novice. I am treading a kind of personal terra incognita. And there is always a choice in such a situation. Either I step back within familiar disciplinary territory, or I attempt to understand an experience shared in unknown terrain by exploring relevant insights from scholars in allied fields, perhaps. I prefer exploring potential new insight as I look for meaningful ways to complement the work of other scholars. This is how I think about opportunities for collaboration. It is one way that I will look to find ways of making connections for my students, and I am always looking to make these connections while working together with other colleagues and faculty further afield to develop interdisciplinary learning opportunities in my coursework and in my research. So what does this mean for my teaching? As I've suggested in these stories, doing ethnographic work involves an intimate understanding of everyday lives of people who allow us to see into rich worlds of experience and meaning. Given this unique and privileged access, students learn of the need to treat people with honor and respect, and to appreciate diverse opinions and backgrounds and understand what they see and hear within cultural, social, and historical contexts. We also learn to find ways to do work that gives back. This same approach of respect and reciprocity, of give and take, is fundamentally important in an effective classroom. It is my responsibility as teacher and mentor to create a learning environment where students can appreciate the centrality of an informed, broad-minded engagement with individuals and groups who may possess ways of making meaning that are different from their own. This is just the kind of sensitivity that is learned in doing ethnographic fieldwork of everyday life. As I hope these stories have expressed, I've learned to listen carefully and to allow people to express themselves in ways that are meaningful to them. I am open to emergent opportunities of working from where people are, from the bottom up, as I search for patterns that can then be connected with, or perhaps challenge, existing models or theories. While basic to good ethnography, these are also skills that help define an effective teacher. By relating cases from my research, I show students how their own work, whatever or wherever it might be, they must be ready to rethink and continuously adjust their approach in response to ongoing feedback. An effective teacher mimics the ethnographer's process of listening and searching for pattern, making connections, expressing his or her own understanding of what is seen and heard, and continuously adjusting to feedback. By knowing individual students through interaction in and outside the classroom, I will work with them, and I do work with them to think through and respond to intellectual and real-world problems with their own solutions. So where to from here? I find myself now here in West Virginia, after years in Michigan and years in Indonesia. And since I'm here, I want to focus on things that are meaningful in this place and that tie to the rich experiences that I've had through working with others in other places, finding ways to make meaningful insights into understanding my new place. And West Virginia, as I say, is a remarkable place. Since separating from Virginia at the time of the Civil War, West Virginia has arguably been in an ongoing state of liminality, a term that anthropologists use to describe being betwixt and between, literally neither here nor there. As a place, West Virginia may be thought of as a kind of borderland. For example, it sits just to the south of the Mason-Dixon line. While this point of separation has its origins in a geographically surveyed line meant to settle colonial era disputes over territory, it's subsequently become a far more significant division between so-called free states to the north and slave states to the south. Since the abolition of slavery in the Civil War, this real and imagined border has evolved even further. It has become a fundamental part of the nation's sense of self. The Mason-Dixon line now serves as a kind of rough cultural boundary, a sort of ideological watershed where ideas are thought to flow one way or the other across an imaginary divide. Where West Virginia should be placed, however, is not always entirely clear in the popular imagination. This is the nature of such cultural symbols. They can be murky and are definitely in flux. West Virginia is also positioned at the fuzzy edge of what is known as the Rust Belt, a term used to conjure an image of decaying industrial places from another economic era. Huntington sits right at the border, where I am right now at Marshall. History suggests that Huntington is part of a large network of once booming industrial communities that span the Midwest and northern tier of states. It's an important site in this broad archipelago, Huntington, as it's tied to a golden era, as well as its late 20th century decline. West Virginia is especially significant in terms of the rise of the railroad industry, natural resource extraction, and labor organization, all of which have played important roles in local, regional, and national history. More recently, experience in the state chronicles decline in these areas. According to figures from the U.S. Census, Huntington has been losing a significant amount of its population, on the order of 10 to 15% nearly every decade since the 1960s. Although this has slowed somewhat in the past decade, it continues. In recent times, the state of West Virginia as a whole has seen little, if any, population growth. Like the communities in Michigan where I recently worked, in the shadow of what were once the big three automakers, many parts of West Virginia are faced with increasing uncertainty and instability within the context of ongoing deindustrialization. All of these many places are seemingly adrift in a competitive, globalizing world in which they are required to aggressively attract both physical and social capital in order to succeed. With a new economy imperative, what strategies will they follow to recovery? The predominant model for encouraging investment in migration and population retention has for some time relied on rolling back taxes and providing cheap land and labor in an attempt to land a single large employer. This has been referred to as smokestack chasing. An alternative approach attempts to preserve and enhance quality of life in order to attract migrants, like those I worked with in Michigan, who are interested in pursuing particular lifestyle choices which emphasize quality of life and livability. My recent research has shown that these migrants exhibit extremely high rates of entrepreneurship. Understanding changes in the culture of family and work helps us to understand what is driving migration patterns. This knowledge may open up new opportunities for communities in decline to reimagine their place in a complex, globalized landscape of place-based economic competitiveness. Despite a recent history of often mixed, sometimes bleak economic conditions, the communities of Metro Valley are in many ways perfect places to conduct research on new forms of work, new kinds of entrepreneurship and community building, and the marketing of place according to emerging cultural and economic models that may stand in sharp contrast to the dominant order of the industrial era. Signs of innovation which challenge conventional wisdom should not surprise us in these places. Innovation is often born of necessity. And I can see this kind of innovation here at Marshall, where tight budgets necessitate strategic planning to clarify the university's place and purpose in higher education and economic development in the state and region. In a region where the organization of worker unions was pivotal in defining the terms for work on the busy shop floors and mines of industry over the past century, changes wrought by global economic restructuring and competition create an exceptional opportunity for considering the possibilities for new arrangements of work, family, and community in everyday life. Considering its geographic location at the edge of the Mason-Dixon line and Rust Belt, split by the Ohio River, and constituting a loose assemblage of politically different urban units in three different states, the Huntington-Ashland-Ironton area could become a very interesting case for studying the effects of a range of social, political, cultural, economic, and environmental factors on the process of reimagining and remarketing geographic place for economic recovery. Further, with ongoing initiatives to rebrand the Metro Valley in terms of a new era of health or bioscience, and with capital investments by the state of West Virginia to realize these initiatives, we may see a gradual immigration of formerly underrepresented ethnic and other social groups. This migration would add an additional element of complexity along with diversity to this picture. As part of the liminality that I mentioned previously, West Virginia is actively questioning what it is as a place, as a state, and a would-be player in the emerging post-industrial and global economic order. What is West Virginia, and how is it represented in the popular mind? What do these images say about cultural understandings? How will it reimagine itself? It is a critical time to engage in important work, not only in terms of the growth and development of existing and future resources in the state and the region, but also for the preservation of essential elements of a storied past in ways that help people to contextualize and understand the meaningful decisions that they must make today. In overseeing student projects at Marshall, it's my long-term goal to articulate a vision of how these projects might collectively contribute to a greater locally defined good. At present, I'm working over time to develop community partnerships, even as I conduct my own research in themes like those I just discussed. I'm working to develop reciprocal relationships where student work is understood and will be understood increasingly as cumulative in terms of what this work might do to increase general knowledge and understanding among different stakeholders in the region's future. This accumulated contribution and the relationships that would be built can achieve both strict educational objectives as well as those goals which our work could identify in the community and which Marshall University is ever more a player. Students will proceed in their work knowing that it has greater purpose, contributes to a greater good, and beyond the grade that they will receive at the end of the term, has meaning. Finally, I am returning to a point that I made at the beginning, that what is important about my scholarly work are the questions that motivate me to do what I do. These are fundamentally important to knowing where I've been and where I'm going. They're essential to knowing what I feel is my calling in the classroom and in the field, in the research that I do. Collectively, these questions may be distilled down to one most basic query, one which I ask as a way of learning about culture and individual motivation. By what means do people endeavor to create meaningful and fulfilling lives for themselves and their families in Michigan, in Sulawesi, in West Virginia, indeed, anywhere on earth? So here at the end, we return to how my research applies to the world, to everyday life, and the experiences of people who work to provide for themselves and for their families in the context of sometimes bewildering social, cultural, and economic change. So thank you for your attention in my presentation here. And do you want to learn more? Have a look at my website, brianhoey.com. There's quite a bit more there, and I'd welcome your visit. Thank you so much again.